the razors and blades example is canonical, I guess. And it doesn't make any sense to me. I had this idea a few years ago, but it didn't make any sense. And I dutifully sent myself an email about it somewhere. And then what happened recently is technology's changed. And so the existence of Google Book Search, which I've written a number of papers on, makes it easy to at least dig a little bit and start to get a feel for what was going on. And then you can figure out how to dig more seriously. So the transaction costs of doing research have dropped. And so this puzzle which I had now is one that I think I can gain some traction on. I don't think I understand it still, but I understand better why I don't understand it. So maybe I start here. So this is from Time magazine in September of 1927, and it's an article on razor blade counterfeiting. It really is. It's amazing how that works. Yes, they really saw into the future back then. Yes, and the article talks about the counterfeiting of Gillette blades, Gillette being the dominant razor blade company of the day. But what it says at the very end, they drop a footnote and they say, well, look, you know, everyone knows, really, you make your money in this business not from the razors, but from the blades, right? And that's the, as I say, the canonical vision of razors and blades. Chris Anderson, in his book last year on Free, Chris Anderson of A Long Tale, he actually starts the book with a story about Gillette. King Gillette, who names their kid King, but apparently Gillette's parents did. King Gillette, gave away a bunch of razors, got partners, and that's how he made the money. And he comes to that at the very end of his story, this marriage of blades and razors, and that's what web entrepreneurs are going to have to do going forward. Now, there are only two problems with that story, I think. It doesn't seem to work in theory, and it doesn't match the facts. Otherwise, it's a good story. So the theory, the simple version of a theory is gosh, you know, anytime you're engaging in one of these two-part sales models, if you're losing money on the razors and you're making money on the blades, someone else has got a better business strategy, which is just to sell the blades, right? Let some other suckers sell the razors. You don't have to lose money there. You sell the blades, right? So there's an obviously superior business strategy available. Unless there's some way to lock the two together, right? That's what you got to have. You got to have a lock. And it turns out Gillette had a lock. From 1904 to 1921, Gillette had two very powerful patents. Those patents were on razors, those patents were on blades, those patents were on the combination. And so they had a lock. And so Gillette actually had the mechanism to engage in a razors and blades and strategy, and they didn't do it. That's not what they did. So I don't know what to make of it. It's much more interesting. Well, that's what I'm going to tell you. That's why we're here. So we start before Gillette. In the era before Gillette, I don't know where you want to start. I'll start with the Yale Literary Magazine, June 1889. What you see here is the razor of the day is a very high-tech product. You see the patents list here. You also understand that they know who their audience is. They get a quote from Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes saying, oh, this is a great product, you gotta use it. The Star Safety Razor, which you can see what it looks like. Okay, well, he'd written a book in which he actually talks about this razor. Amazing, right? And the one distinctive feature of this razor as compared to what Gillette would come up with was that the blade itself is a wedge blade. And the wedge is important because the wedge is what provides stability, but also makes it an expensive blade. There's a lot of bulk there. There's a lot of steel going into that. Okay. Now, if you actually go back and look at the, and I've been spending a lot of time with the catalogs of the day, they're just wonderful. I mean, wow, they're just fabulous. If you actually go look, it turns out that the safety type razor that I just showed you a picture of, that was actually quite unusual. Most razors of the day were this kind of razor, the straight razor. And you could buy one of those in the Montgomery Ward catalog from 1895. Montgomery Ward is basically the Amazon of its day. It's really quite remarkable. You could buy one of those razors for 60 cents. I want to keep prices in mind. I've been trying to obviously track the prices here. 60 cents. You could also go really high-end. If you wanted German silver, right, and pearl handles, you could spend $3.50. But most of these are in the $1.20 range. So 60 cents, $1.20, you know. And they've got like 35 straight razors, and then they've got this one, right, the Star Safety razor. The razor plus blade is $1.50. An extra blade is $1, so implicitly the razor handle's being sold for 50 cents. They'll also do repairs, regrinding, sharpening, right? One of the critical things, as you understand, is that obviously there was a lot of maintenance involved in either managing the Star razor or the standard straight blade razors. You had to strop and hone and sharpen. I don't even know what those terms mean, to be perfectly honest. They just show up all the time. Miles in the back is making a hand gesture. I assume that's not offensive in Italian, but okay. So where do we go from there? So Gillette files for patents, right? All the patents are online, obviously. Google's done a very nice job of that as well. But he's really got, you know, a problem in mind that he's trying to solve. And the problem he's trying to solve is that people do a lousy job of engaging in the kind of maintenance I was just describing, right? People do a bad job of that. And so, and you know, it's time consuming, it's expensive, they screw it up. I'm going to solve that. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to have not the wedge blade, the Star right razor, I'm going to have very thin blades, right? And those will be sufficiently thin that we can throw them away. And so people will not have to maintain them. I'll solve the maintenance problem. I will make the blades disposable by changing the design of the blades. He creates a structure such that he doesn't need the mass of the blade to have a stable shave. That's what he patents, right? Now, he doesn't patent a business method. He wasn't obviously smart enough to see into the future as we sit here waiting for Bilski, right? That will be interesting in just a second. But that's what Gillette does, okay? And then he puts it on sale, right? And so you can go, and this is what Google Book Search is really good for, you can go and read magazines of the era and run searches and see exactly what he was doing. You search for Gillette razors. Yeah, and critical for this purpose is that, you know, most people are interested in the stories. I'm interested in the ads, right? And that's the stuff that it's actually typically harder to find. Yes, I suspect you can search on stropping and honing, though, as well. But what you see here is the Gillette business model is we'll sell you a handle, we'll sell you a dozen blades, we'll put it in a case, we'll sell it to you for $5. $5. Not a low price, $5, right? And they say, it's interesting to see how the business model evolves as you watch these, right? 10 blades, you use them, send them to us, we'll sharpen them. $5. Let's put $5 in a little bit of a context. So you go to the New York Times from roughly that time, John Wanamaker, who had been Philadelphia's department store magnate, has moved to New York, taken over a store there. They're selling men's suits for $12. $12. They were on sale. The season was changing, right? $12. Women's fall costumes, right? $12.50. And then an ad for the Gillette safety razor. $5. Dozen blades. Yes, exactly, right? You're really bad at this, right? You don't know how to strop it. Okay, we're going to sell you a razor. So rather than selling, right, low-priced razors, right, remember, I could buy a straight blade razor for 60 cents. I could buy the Star for $1.50. Right, I could buy a men's suit for $12. They announce a price of $5 for a combination of case, razor, and a dozen blades. Expensive product, not a cheap product. So, you know, they sell, you know, 50 of these in 1903, and then their sales, you know, of the razor between 1904 and 1908, well, you can see, I mean, it actually is a successful product, though we'll get a sense of how successful as we look at more numbers. Right, obviously, the packets rise with razor sales. Obviously, you create an installed base, and you're selling to your installed base.
Packets are just replacements?
Yes, yes, and I say standardized packets. They actually, in terms of doing the numbers over time, it's initially they're selling 12 blades in a packet. Eventually, they switch to 10, so you got to recompute the numbers slightly.
Do you know what the expected life of a razor is?
Oh, man, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, they tell you one thing. Who knows, right?
Say, because, I mean, that's a depreciable asset.
Oh, absolutely.
And so you probably got
to... No question.
You can't simply run an integral on the one line.
Well, I'm sure we can't do that, yes. Okay, so Gillette launches that business. Now, as I say, they didn't patent a business method. So there are instantly other competitors in this multi-blade model. So Vajem Jr., $1, 7 blades. Note what they're advertising at the bottom, never a dull blade, new blades for old. Windahl, you can use these blades, you can strop them, you can take care of them, but you don't like that, send them to us, and for 25 cents, we'll send you new ones, right? Again, what we want to think about is the power. Here's what I care about. To what extent do we think Gillette had the ability to exploit this razors and blades model, right? Well, I say initially, gosh, they're not doing it at all. They're selling very high prices for razors, right? But I also want to look at what their competitors were doing and the pressure that was going to put on Gillette. So if you really wanted to use another multi-blade razor, this one was a buck, right? The EverReady, a buck, right? Same kind of deal, right? Yeah, you can strop them if you want, but we'll send you 6 brand new ones if you send us 6 old ones, 25 cents, right? Again, Gillette's competitors, who were using the same multi-blade strategy that Gillette was using, right, charging a much lower price, right, and seemingly relatively low prices for replacement blades.
Why was this not infringement?
Because these were single-edge blades and not double-edge blades. We actually do get infringement. We get someone who enters the Gillette blade market. Gillette litigates that lawsuit and wins, but not anything vis-a-vis Gem and EverReady, okay? Sears runs ads. Sears, the catalog, says, you know, this is from 1912. They talk about the Gillette razor. you can't read this. We don't claim that this razor will give any better satisfaction. This razor is manufactured under a license price of $5. We are therefore forced to charge $5. Here it is, right? Sears would have liked to charge a lower price, right? It's got EverReady's for much less than that, right? Says, I'm sorry, we know some of you guys want it. We don't think it's any better. $5 because we're forced to charge it, right? Yes, Tom, please.
Randy, what do we know about the quality of the EverReady versus the quality of the Gillette, right? Because, I mean, I can go to CVS and I can buy a razor for it's terrible, back with a face that's chewed up, right?
So. Google book search, unfortunately, doesn't solve that problem, right? So there's no question that, you know, the quality dimension is critical. There are actually, as you can imagine, articles a la Consumer Reports talking about different razors of the day. I don't know what to make about those, right? So there are certainly those, not rating systems necessarily.
How about sales quantities?
Well, I can get to sales quantities on Gillette. I haven't seen sales quantities on EverReady or Gem, right? And then part of obviously the nature of this is while Google Book Search is great, it's not perfect. And so I'm still filling in holes. So, no, you really can't. So Gillette yearly razor sales, as you can see, from 1903 through this period, they sort of trundle along. And then World War I happens. And they sell a massive amount of them to the government. So they cut a deal with the government, and they sell a huge number of razors to the United States government. Slightly different package, but basically the same razor. So in terms of also thinking about this era, that's sort of an unfortunate distorting factor. Now, what about prices? So I've been going through assembling Sears catalogs. We are missing some of them, so we're going to have to dig. We don't at the University of Chicago seem to have any World War I catalogs. But if you look at Gillette's list price, if you look at the sales price in the Sears catalog for the Gillette set, it's $5 for an extended period of time. Something happens in 1914. I don't know what that is, but Sears, which had been complaining so much, they make us sell it at $5. By 1914, the prices dropped to something like $3.80. So there's a discount in the Sears catalog at that point. That discount basically continues throughout that era, though I'm missing, obviously, data there that we need to fill in. You can also calculate the razor prices. Those are available. I'm sorry, the blade prices. Those are available. And then the implicit price, right, for the handle by taking the 12 blades and removing that. You can see where that price goes, but it remains, right, a premium product throughout the life of the patent. Please, Mark.
An aside, and I can't prove this, right, but 1911, I think, is when resale price maintenance is held illegal.
Well, I had the same thought, so I don't know. Yes, same thought. So, you know, I teach Dr. Miles, or at least used to teach Bob Merrill. Obviously, that was that era. Get it. Okay. So, during the patent life, Gillette doesn't seem to play razors and blades. At the point where they had the lock to do it, they don't seem to do it, right? It just doesn't seem to be what they do. They charge a very high price for the razor, right? If the idea is to give away razors, make the money off the blades, it doesn't seem to be Gillette's strategy at the time that they were best situated to play that strategy, okay? Now, the razors, the patents are granted in 1904. The patents are going to expire in November of 1921. 6 months before that, Gillette says, here's what we're going to do, guys. So they run ads in the Wall Street Journal, and they announce they've got a new, better razor with new patents. They say the old razor, that was great. Best advance in 5,000 years, right? Wow, who knew? But we've got something better. It's 75% more efficient. I don't know what that means, right? But that's what they say. 75% more efficient. We're going to sell it. Sets of $5 to $75 for the really high-end fancy model. God only knows what that looked like, right? They also say, this is sort of interesting, right? At the very bottom they say, oh, guys, if you're using Gillette razor blades in imitation razors, we don't know what's going to happen. You ought to be careful about that. Which is a little weird in one way and not weird in another way. Weird in one way, which is to say, look, if Gillette's charging a really high price for blades, they ought to be happy with whatever you do with them, right? Drink them, eat them, do what you want with them, right? In contrast, if they're worried, obviously, about how quality is going to be assessed and you mix two products together, you've got standard issues there, right? Please, Mark.
Also, I mean, on the standard model, you would expect that ad to be exactly the reverse.
Absolutely the reverse. Yeah. Completely. Right. Exactly.
Know what razor you're using, so this ad seems to be just be like blah, 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 blah.
No, it's too big to be blahs.
Well, no, it's big because I blew it up. I mean, it's down the little corner there, but...
They don't know if you're using somebody else's handle, so that's just useless.
Yeah,
but look what they're trying to stop you from doing. Of course, it's precatory, right? But they're not trying to stop you from using imitation blades with the genuine razor. Right. They're trying to stop you from using imitation razors with the genuine blades.
That's my point, exactly. Yeah, I'm with you.
Which is the type of product.
Yeah. Okay, so this is 6 months prior to the expiration of the patents. So they're ready to go. They've got new patents, but they don't have new blade patents. Okay, that will be interesting in just a second. So here's what they do. We turn to the Montgomery's Ward catalog in 1922, and look what we see here. So the new standard Gillette package, $5 list, being sold at a discounted price of $4.25, okay? Sort of like what I was seeing in the Sears catalog. At least as interesting, though, Gillette repackages the old razor and says, you know, now that our patent's expired, people are going to be able to make our old razor, and they're going to be able to sell it at a relatively low price. We're going into that market, right? So they announced the Brownie, right? The Brownie is just the old razor, three blades, artificial leatherette, artificial leather-covered metal case, and they sell that for 85 cents. Now, that price matches almost exactly the price of the Eveready and the Gem. So the market segments, right? This sounds like now, if we want to go all Chris Anderson, freemium, right? They've got sort of a low price version and a high price version. Though all the blades, it's only one set of blades, and the blades are being charged for a single price, right? So there's no distinction between the blades for these two markets, right?
So still, all the value is in the handle. Is that what they're telling us?
Well, that's the strategy they play from 1904. To 1921. By 1927, remember I said there were no blades patents, new blades patents? You see entry in the blade market. So anywhere you see three holes, that's a Gillette-compatible blade. The Fax brand, the Stay Sharp, Gillette Actuals here, Radium here, Speedway here. So exactly the kind of entry you would have expected, right? What seems to happen here is Gillette seems to effectively deter entry into the handle market by going low-end itself, right? Because they don't have new patents on the blades, you should anticipate entry into the blade market. That's what we see. Again, your ability to play razors and blades effectively depends upon the fact that people can't enter the blade market, And they couldn't between 1904 and 1921, but after 1921 they could, and they did, right? Exactly what you would expect. Sales, right? Well, look at this, right? So, yeah, exactly. Wow, right? It turns out there's no question that Gillette was leaving a bunch of razor sales and razor blade sales on the table, right? So this blip, which looked so big before, this is the World War I government sale. After they moved to this new strategy, right, they seem to be selling the new high-end set relatively well, and the Brownie takes off, right? Yes, the Brownie is, yeah, I'm sorry. How can you not know Gillette? Okay.
At 1/6 of the price.
Absolutely.
These are unit sales, these are not dollars.
Oh yes, but yes, absolutely right. Though we'll get to dollars in just a second.
These are the old razors plus the new razors.
Absolutely, and I have not seen a breakdown of those figures. I've seen some stuff about it, but I don't actually have numbers. Yes. And then what happens to standard packets, right? So the handle sales are going up and the blade sales. And then profits. Profits do pretty well until this depression thing kicks in, right?
Even then.
Have they diversified or is this all razor blades?
They eventually diversify. I have three different Gillette corporate histories. So they eventually diversify, but I don't think at this point they're particularly diversified. Yes.
Still a one-horse pony.
Pretty much so. Yes. I got to think.
At least it's what? Those net earnings? Is that $2 million, right?
Well, at the top there, you're at 16. That 18 is the top line. They go up to maybe 16. Yes, yes, yes. So the company's doing well. Now, try to think about what the emergence of competition means. So this is, I think, a very crude measure. But I'll tell you what I did. Basically, I took the installed base of blades and I acted like the installed base of razor handles, and I acted as if the handles never went away, okay? That's obviously extreme. Miles will tell me what the right way to do it is here in a few minutes. That'll be useful, right? But that's what I did. And then I said, okay, let's assume that basically the entire installed base going into a year needs to buy blades. What happens? And how many packets of blades are they buying? And what you can see is that peaks, and then as we enter the era of competition in blades, it goes down, right? Which is exactly, it changes, but yes. Yes.
So that's blade.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've obviously standardized across the changes in how we do it.
And so your basic argument is it's going down because they're buying the substitute blades and putting them on the handle.
Seems to be, right?
And you put the two of them together, you'd expect the line to continue to go up as the market expands. That is, the raise.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's no question that notwithstanding the emergence of competition, right? I mean, you know, you might say, wow, they don't seem to have any locks at this point. They're doing really well. How interesting, right? Maybe, but...
Actually, but if there's cheap, there's competition in the blade market, doesn't that mean that they're actually going to get more sales in the handle or in the razor market?
Well, the handle market, I don't know what to make of it is, right? So they've got, obviously, their strategy at this point, post the expiration of the 1904 patents in 1921, is they've got a high-end handle, the $5 handle, the new improved, which turned out not to be that great a product, actually. And then, so the quality point, yeah. And then they've got, obviously, the low-end old razor, the Brownie, right? And they seem to be selling a zillion Brownies and then selling a zillion blades.
Well, why can't the competitors enter with the low-end stuff and compete with the Brownie?
Well, I mean, I don't know, is that the quality explanation? So EverReady and GEM had been in place all along, right? And now what happens post-1921, pre-1921, we have high-end Gillette, low-end EverReady and GEM. Post-1921, we continue to have high-end Gillette, but we also have low-end Gillette. That's the change in the market you see in 1921, and then the emergence, obviously, of the compatible blades.
Randy?
Yes, please.
Are you flirting with the idea in your head of comparing this to the pharmaceutical pricing model?
Well, I hadn't gone there, but so I really just want to understand how you make money with and without locks. I really care about things like the Xbox, right?
Yeah. Or tennis rackets, laptop computers, all sorts of things that price premium early for people who are early adopters and low late.
Well, I hear that. I mean, I'm more interested in these two-part markets. That's what I'm interested in. I mean, I'm happy to talk about that too, but...
All I was trying to suggest is they could be versions of the same thing.
Well, yeah, what's interesting about this, I would never have known this, is that this looks like initially a two-part market situation, And then post-1921, it's both a two-part market and a low-end, high-end, right? No question about that. That's what happens in 1921. Please, Chris.
So the question is, that, I mean, for me, you're wondering how this strategy works without locks. And
yes.
There's a lock. It's just not a patent lock. And the lock may be that razors are a very intense experience, right? You, in advance,
maybe.
You can't ascertain what they're going to be like. And then you shave with them, and your face doesn't hurt, and you think, this thing works. And then that, of course, flows into the goodwill attaches to the trademark. And maybe that's what Gillette uses as a driver.
Maybe.
If you go into CVS, the Gillette razors are more expensive than Wilkinson or Schick, right? They have some magic that attaches to them, and this obviously goes back.
They're the best a man can get.
There you go.
What's interesting about this, of course, is the experimentation costs on the alternative razors are really low, right? So basically, it looks like that the EverReady and the Gem. Did I say? All right, but the EverReady and Gem are priced basically at the cost of a pack of replacement blades for the Gillette, right? So unlike, other things, one of the things that's interesting about this model is, or the situation is, if I've got an Xbox and I build up a stack of games, if I wanted to switch to the PlayStation, I forfeit those games, right? So the installed base of things I bought matters. That's not the case here. These are actually disposable. They go away. So at the point when I've used my last Gillette razor and I walk into the store, right, I face a dollar pack of Gillette blades, or I can buy the entire new razor and a pack of blades from EverReady for a dollar, right? And so, I hear the psychological experimentation costs, get those, right? But the actual out-of-pocket experimentation costs are really quite low.
What happens to the sale of Gem in this period?
I don't have those figures, right? I mean, I just...
Is this just the fact that all of a sudden everybody's moving into this market and they're getting a smaller share or they're getting a larger share of the market?
Don't know. I mean, obviously there's a transition here, right? So when you read the articles of the era, there's obviously, we haven't said a word about this. Are you going to self-shave or not is the starting question, right? So a lot of people are actually getting shaved at the barber. So this is a market for self-shavers. And obviously one of the things they try to do is to get people to substitute out of professional shaving to self-shaving.
And by the way, I take it the electrics have not yet come in.
No. Right? Okay. So that's where we were. And then the prices post-1904 patents, I've sort of talked about that a little bit. So, and then the question is what happens? And it turns out things even get more interesting. So this is a patent from 1927 by Henry Gaisman. Gaisman runs a different razor company called Autostrop, which sort of had a bundle of a stropping machine and a razor. And then what they do is they obviously come up with this idea of basically trying to limit competition in the, this is so clever, it's just so clever, right? What they obviously try to do is effectively build the trademark into the locking mechanism into the patent, right? Please.
You have... Sega versus Apple.
Yeah, I get it, right? Except this is 1927. Yeah, okay, good. Give him credit.
That's the mechanism?
Oh, well, we've got another mechanism. Autostrop actually comes up with a different blade. That's this blade. This blade is both backwards compatible in that it will fit the Gillette razors, but it doesn't fit the new Autostrop handles, right? Now, Tom's quality question. Gaisman tried to sell this technology to Gillette, and Gillette said no, okay? And it gets released in the marketplace. I don't have sales figures, Richard's question. But Gillette acts like it's really scared, right? So what Gillette does is Gillette immediately announces, New York Times, March 7th, 1930, a new razor and a new blade. But as you can see there, what it says is patents pending. So Gillette goes to market before it actually has its patents, and then it gets sued. So Autostrop sues them, and 6 months later, there's a deal where they effectively are buying Autostrop. But when you say buying Autostrop, at the end of this process, even though Autostrop was a much smaller company, King Gillette is gone out of the country, out of the company, and Henry Gaisman has taken over. That's the story. Please, Chris. You will leave him wanting more. Isn't that the lesson? So I don't know, how far do you want me to go? Gillette just, as you may have seen,
really... obviously.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, one could go on, right? I guess where I wanted to go on this is try to understand this razors and blades conundrum, right? This canonical example. right? I'll say a little bit more since you'd like me to say more, right? It seems like they don't play razors and blades between 1904 and 1921, right? In 1921, their strategy shifts. So their strategy basically is to have high end and low end and match the pricing strategy of EverReady and GEM. They then start to get razors and blades type interactions, though it's forced upon them. And then eventually the company gets in trouble because they seem to lose sight of technology and someone gets a better patent. That's the end of that story. Chris is here, Ben Omri, and then Becky. Sorry.
So I wonder about your sales figures, right? Because they seem to assume that the number of men shaving is held constant over time. And beard growth is falling.
Good, I should deal something with that.
Right around that period, right? Americans go to war, they shave all the time, and all of a sudden they come.
There's
back
no
and shave
question the war is huge for Gillette, and they eventually start selling a women's shaver as well.
Also, though, not just because these men, shave with Gillettes while they're at war and, have brand loyalty when they return, but they become, clean shaven men after they've gone to the war, and prior to that they were all beard growers.
Yeah, there's no question that part of what goes on in this business is the most important thing is to determine, how many of your customers you can get to be persuaded they need to remove every hair from their body. So that's the strategy, and that is something I need to take into account. Omri's next.
So I'm trying to understand what to learn from the fact that until 1921 they didn't play the razors and, whatever they did with the razors and blades. We saw that they weren't selling very much other than little blip.
Maybe they were stupid.
So maybe, if now shift to the printers and ink, what should the printer manufacturer learn from their mistake?
Yeah, okay.
They wasted 20 years.
So good. So let's talk about that for just a second. So part of what, I don't know if this is what was going on. Part of what obviously they had to worry about was that people would continue to maintain the blades, right? People were in the habit, who were self-shavers, of maintaining blades. And so you can't really play razors and blades meaningfully if you're going to sell them a pack of blades and they're actually going to work very hard to maintain those blades, right? So getting people out of the habit of maintaining blades is critical. And maybe Gillette, and maybe correctly, I don't know, right, understood that for an extended period of time, they were going to have trouble selling people a lot of blades because they were going to maintain them. Now, you take that over to the toner cartridge model, that doesn't go anywhere, right? There's no self-provisioning strategy seemingly available there that might have been available here. Becky.
So I'm wondering, where did we get this myth? Did you do any research into when people started talking about the razors and blades, or who made it up, or why?
I think the story is new, but I haven't seen the story I just told somewhere else. I think it's new. And I don't know, right? So obviously, Time Magazine 1927 says, everyone knows that's how you make your money. Time Magazine 1927.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I started. Everyone says, that's how you make your money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
But it's linked to an argument about the benefits of price discrimination, right? That's typically how. Yes.
Say more about that.
Yeah, but it's not here.
So you say, why is it that you have a tot? And the reason you
I have papers on that. Go ahead.
No, I know. So the argument that you hear all the time is we have a tie and don't break it up because this is the way that we meter, right? We separate out high value users from low value users. And so that's often the way the example comes
that's
up.
That here.
Right.
And not only that, there's no way you could do it because of easy transferability.
So were people arguing about tying in 1927?
Yes, that's actually explicit in the Supreme Court cases on counters in the 1890s and 1905s. These are the button fastener cases. Those are briefed by, and there's more with me, Fisher Richardson.
Right. More? Please, Jonathan.
I guess it's maybe not as shocking that Time says that in 1927 than it would be if Time said that in 1921 before anyone was really playing reason.
Agreed.
So maybe
but when you say that, just so we're clear, right, I think it's fair to say, though I'm still pinning this down, that EverReady's and GEM's strategies don't change throughout the period. So there's a way in which you might say EverReady and GEM were playing razors and blades pre-1921, right? Now, the limitation on that is, and I don't have the data yet, but I have examples, there are clearly compatible blades, EverReady, GEM compatible blades being sold in that period. So their ability, as it were, to extract large profits on the blades had to be affected by the existence of these compatible blades.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So that was also sort of in addition. in order to evaluate Gillette's strategy from 1904 to 1921, we have to know maybe two important things. Right? So number one, what Tom was talking about with the quality of the market.
No question.
Maybe at that point, that what they think their big advantage of is that, so that's the reason why when the patent expires, they change their strategy.
Could be.
And the second thing is that, you know, it seems as though they're leaving a lot of money on the table because all of a sudden when they start offering the brownie at 89
yes.
cents, the profits go way up. Then we don't know what it did to the brand to be selling that better razor for $5.
You mean the new razor?
What it did to the brownie, what became the brownie, what was the standard Gillette razor, to be selling it at the higher $5 price for those 17 years, right? So you sell a Porsche at a high price for 2 decades, and then you drop the price off that everyone wants it because it's a Porsche that you can get at a lower rate. So it might be that 17 years, if they had sold the brownie at 89 cents in 1904, they're not making nearly the money off of it that they are
but
in 1921 after 17 years of
it. Yeah, I hear that.
So it doesn't seem like, if they gave it a brand name, it doesn't seem like they would...
Well, but it's a Gillette brownie, right? I mean, they create the name Gillette over that period.
I'm interested to know whether Gillette made up the word brownie, nobody ever used it, or whether that was what people were all calling that Gillette razor beforehand, and now they're just tying in this razor that you've seen on the stores for $5, 89 cents.
They don't even actually. That's that name actually. If we're going to do that for just a second, you know, that name seems to actually go away pretty quickly. So. The brownie name. Certainly the Sears catalogs aren't describing it that way. Scott, and then here.
Can you say a little bit more about your answer on the toner cartridges being ink? Because
sure.
I thought I heard you say that it was hard to self-refill.
That's wrong.
And well, it's, are you saying it's hard technically or legally or both? Because...
Yeah, that's fair. So
made a huge difference to the availability of that.
No question, right? So the Lexmark cases, right? Right, exactly. Yeah, that's fair. Obviously, I mean, you know, I was going to raise this during Mark's talk, I guess. I mean, so they obviously went with an effort at a technological tie there. They start with a contractual tie, right? That fails because, and this was, I thought, the lesson of this morning, though we knew this coming in, no one actually pays attention to the terms of contracts, right? That was Florencia's discussion. That was Mark's discussion, right? No one actually pays attention to, until we get litigation, right? Yeah, but what happens here is when Lexmark recognizes that they're trying to separate these markets through contract and no one's paying any attention, do you know these cases? They actually put a technological chip in to do that. And then what happens then is you get the reverse engineering of that chip and the DMCA issue that kicks in, right? If that case comes out differently, that market works out differently.
A whole set of direct patent infringement cases that are
yes.
partially inducement and partially direct, and the way the Federal Circuit ends up getting itself to its answer is it decides that kind of the customer had to have been buying a license to the plurality of patents at the time the customer was buying the license to the cartridge.
Exactly.
So they're ultimately first sale cases or exhaustion cases. I happen to think they're wrong, but
yeah.
That didn't surprise you. But it's a strong, like, you'll be surprised, I think, with the opinion. It goes really far.
Okay,
and
sounds like I need to look at those.
Packard versus Rapido type stencil.
Okay, I'll look at that. We have like 3 minutes. Please, I'm sorry, yes.
Do you know how much it costs to manufacture the brownie?
I really don't. I mean... There's
in that case, it's like the Xbox just based
on. Yeah, exactly. So the Xbox strategy, as you know, is that we have figures on, right? When they released that, they were selling that at a price where, they're losing $150 a copy, right? And obviously you understand why they need to lock then to the licenses for the games, because that's the place to make money. The Gillette corporate biographies talk a little bit about some of the cost information, but not in any real detail. I just don't seem to know. Well, we know they were overall. Absolutely. Mark.
So this is in the sort of random fact in the origins story. Around the turn of the century, so while Standard Oil is still a monopoly, they entered the China market by giving away 8 million kerosene lamps in China, figuring that they would then be the ones to sell the oil.
That's interesting.
So it was a... I think it was a business strategy that had existed even in advance of this.
Well, and the truth of the matter is I didn't say anything about when giveaways kick in, right? I mean, so that's what obviously Chris Anderson's talking about. The first Gillette giveaway seems to be a deal in 1923, an obvious product linkage between the razor and chewing gum. Really? Okay. But that's what they did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they did it with the Wrigley Company, right. That seems to be the first actual giveaway.
Yeah. Please, Douglas.
I understand you don't want to talk about this.
Okay, then I won't. What is it?
You have 3 minutes not to talk about it.
Just speculating, I got the latest Gillette razor.
Oh, yes.
And it was $4 for the razor and the blade, and individual blades, I think, are around $4. And so I understand that it's a myth, but could you explain exactly?
Well, it's not to say that it doesn't work today, right? I mean, they may have good locks on the razor blade market because of technology or patents of a like, right? I don't, Richard's question, why did you stop, right? Well, I guess when am I supposed to stop? But I don't, there's obviously an entire history post 1930 that I know a little bit about, but not that much about. And so, what controls the linkage between the Gillette razor you just bought the other day and the blades right now? I could guess at a number of things, and it's possible that they have exactly the right locks to make that pricing model work, right? What's historically interesting is that at the point of genesis, they didn't do it that way.
But even today, there's still not, according to your model, there's still a theoretical difference, right? Switching costs are very low. There's no install base today.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what to make of that, right? I mean, I guess we can sample the room, but I don't know what to make of that. I heard what Chris Sprigman said, right? I don't know. Please.
No, I just want to say the technology is in the blade. The blade is patented, so. There's a patent on the blade.
I understand that, okay, but Brady's theoretical observation that there's no install base equivalent.
Right.
If you got one patent technology for which you don't have competition and one technology for which you do have competition, you'd expect the price of the
certainly
razor.
Certainly
would. Yeah. By the way, do you have a story on the toner case? Do you think the model works there?
Well, I have this other paper. I'll be Richard. I'll say, I've got another paper you should read, right? Anytime I see Richard, he says, oh, you should read my paper on this. So, no, right? I have a paper on technological markets and time and the like, and it's, price discrimination and the virtues and vices of that. What I focus on in that paper, just if you'll be serious for a second, is I think the question in those markets is do you think you have robust systems competition? If you think you do, then you should permit locks, as it were, between the two products and assume that the systems competition will take care of that. And it's interesting, if you watch that market, see the different strategies. So Kodak has been very clear in going into that market recently and saying, we're selling more expensive printers, but boy, you're going to be able to buy less expensive toner. Very clear about that business strategy.
Then they have to be able to have exclusives on the toner.
Well, no, they don't. It's the other guys who do.
It's the guy who's handing you the printer who
needs it.
I'm charging a premium, so you get your stuff from wherever
I'll be a good host and say we should stop, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right, but it was great. Thanks.